When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good morning and good afternoon to each and every one of our Merry Marvelites. Thank you so much to everyone hanging out in the live chat right here on Geekscape. I am Christian Blatt, as always. This is Marvel Movie Talk. He is obscuring his lovely face in the box there with the creature. But of course, it is our own creature, Count Eric Connor. And we're very excited to welcome back to the show Kenny Johnson. Kenny, the last time you were on, we talked about having you back for specifically an episode that talks about the season 4 2-part premiere, Prometheus. And you weren't able to, you know, for a couple months, you were able to come up with excuses, but eventually you ran out of it. And you're just like, fine, I'll come back on.
Yeah. You know, just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Exactly. And very excited. And of course, we're joined by Eric Connor, as I mentioned. Very excited to talk to you about this episode. And there's a lot of things in the episode that I want to discuss. But one of the things, you know, I sort of it was interviewing 101 the last time we talked. I saved something I really wanted to talk about for the end, and then we kind of ran out of time. So I think it's important when you talk about this show to talk about the music. And I think that this is a perfect episode to highlight that, because Joe Harnell, who did the music for the show, is also responsible for the end credits music, The Lonely Man, which unfortunately, yeah, because of YouTube regulations, I'm not even going to try to play. But anybody that needs a reminder, you know, we'll play it for the audio version of this. But I thought it was interesting that there was a release. This is from a CD. There's a release specifically for the score for these two episodes. So I thought that's a great way to start talking about Prometheus by talking about the music, talking about the collaboration with Joe. But my first point about this, where does The Lonely Man come from? And the first time you hear it, what is your reaction, Kenny?
Well, the normally, and maybe we mentioned this before, in the days we were doing The Incredible Hulk, most of the episodic television shows, when they got to the closing credits, they all had a sort of a rousing or stirring or whatever, big orchestral piece that ended the show. And I said to Joe, he said, what do you want for the end? And I said, what I want is, it's a lonely guy. It's a solo guy, and he's walking away. And so I think it should just be a solo piano, Joe, which Joe loved, of course, because he's primarily a pianist. And I said, and it needs to be a very simple piece that has pathos, but is not pathetic, and that gives us a sense of melancholy without, you know, squirming in it, so that it doesn't get over melodramatic. A little bit of the feeling of Eric Satie's Gymnopédie, that are very, very simple pieces, but that they just are haunting when you hear them. Joe said, okay. And Joe was trained classically. He studied with Aaron Copland, and Leonard Bernstein was one of Joe's classmates, as a matter of fact. So finally, after a couple of days working on it by himself, he said, all right, come on over and we'll sit down at the piano and see what you think. And he started playing it for me, and it was really, really exactly the tone and feeling that I was looking for. I had a couple of moments in it I thought maybe could be better. And so I'm sitting on the piano bench beside Joe, and I said, what if it was this note instead of this note? And because I'm something of a musician, Joe always said I was just enough of a musician, and I knew just enough about music to be dangerous. this was one of those prime examples. And I think it was literally one note I changed in the piece, but it gave it, it underlined the tonality that I was looking for even more so. And that's what we went with. And it became as iconic in its own right as the show became and the creature of the Hulk because of Joe's extraordinary talent. And I still mourn his loss. He died many years ago now, but he had done so much work for me for so long on the Bionic. I brought him originally to Hollywood to work on the Bionic Woman. And then he did really all of the Hulk. And then we went on to do V together, which was, of course, an extraordinary score that he wrote for V, which is a whole different show we can talk about sometime. Because the music in V was very specific. And
you and I spoke earlier this year for the 40th anniversary of it, and the music was definitely a big part of it.
Talk about it. Right. Yeah. But Joe was a tremendous helpmate and a tremendous collaborator, and allowed me the freedom to just keep meddling, until we got it right, or the way that seemed the most right to me for the project.
Yeah, and what I love about this CD release is just how many tracks there are. There's no shortage of music presented on here, and I think it's great. So I just wanted to touch on that, and I thought, it was so fitting because of the importance of the music and the score in the episode. So when we spoke previously, we basically focused on the premiere of the show and sort of getting it on the air. And what I found interesting, because I have not watched the like 2.5 seasons in between, I just jumped into season 4. And I think the nature of primetime network television was every episode was probably somebody's first. So you don't want them to be lost. But what were maybe the most significant things heading into the season 4 premiere when, it's clearly very big for television at the time, and your presentation, I think, is going to reflect that. And it definitely stood out for me watching it, 45 years later, or not quite 43 years later. But that so just talk about sort of what happened on the show, but then also with the show behind the scenes in the few years from when it premiered to getting this fourth season.
Sure. Well, very quickly, when I did the pilot for The Incredible Hulk, and we sold the series and it went onto the air, they released my original TV movie pilot of The Incredible Hulk overseas, and maybe I mentioned this to you, as a foreign theatrical release. And I got a call from Universal and they said, "Congratulations, you have the top grossing movie in Europe." And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, "Your pilot, we released it as a foreign theatrical and it's the top grossing picture in Europe. It's outgrossing all the other movies, Woody Allen and a bunch of other shows." And for like almost 2 months, I think it was the top grossing movie over there. Who knew, and it ended up making at the time about, 18 or $20 million, which in 1977, 78 was a huge amount of money overseas, particularly for a TV movie that had only cost about, less than $2 million at the time to make here. So it was surprising to hear. And then to open the second season of the show, I came up with the idea of Married as being the title, which means, wait a minute, Dr. Banner gets married, the Hulk gets married. And it was a very emotional, strongly played show by Bill and Marriott Hartley, who played our leading lady, whom he falls in love with. It's a tragic love story. She is dying. He tries to help her while she's trying to help him with his problem and make the Hulk go away. And Marriott won the Emmy Award for Best Actress in a Drama Series that year, which sort of people said, wait a minute, the Hulk won the Drama Award? And people began to realize, yes, the show was more than just, a big green guy knocking things over. And the studio and the network had already realized that because the ratings showed that we had a broad four quadrant audience where our largest single section of audience was adult women. They were our biggest audience, and then adult men, and then teens, and then kids. And that's the perfect demographic for TV. They love that because the women, of course, are the consumers that drive the commercial aspects of anything. And so Married was a wonderful and obvious follow-up for to open the second season with. And by the third season, as I recall, the third season, and the show was really rolling along. We'd been in the top 20 since we'd initially gone on the air, and in the top 15 or lower most of the time. And we had continued that way. So when we rolled into the third season, we just sort of kept going the way we had been. As I recall, the third season opener was about addiction, about drugs. And Mackenzie Phillips, I believe, played the leading lady in it. And Gary Graham, who later did a became my star on Alien Nation, Gary had a small part in which he gave Dr. Banner LSD or something, and he reminded me of that when he came in to read for me on Alien Nation. By the time we were, Married was so successful also that they released it as a foreign theatrical movie as well. And it also did huge amounts of money over there for them. And again, we had a top grossing movie, you know, that never had a kind of a budget that you would ever expect would have that kind of success overseas. But I think it was the emotional content that really drove it, and drew in all of the people in England and in France and in Germany and in Spain and all. And it was really rewarding. So when we are heading to the fourth season, I said, well, you know what? Let me try to give them another movie they could release overseas, I had been intrigued for quite a while about the concept that there should likely be an organization within our government, between sort of a NASA kind of operation, as a contingency situation. What happens if there actually is a UFO that lands and somebody gets out of it, as in Close Encounters and that sort of thing? And it seemed to me that there must be some corner of the United States government that has got at least a little working plan, a little group of people that have thought about this and what to do if such a thing happened. And I thought that was an interesting premise to begin with. Then as I began to think, okay, well, what can happen if the creature, the Hulk, gets mistaken for an extraterrestrial visitor? And what kind of a situation could that lead to? And at the same time, I was thinking, okay, well, what is coming and gonna hit? Well, it's got to be a meteor or something like that. But maybe if it's shaped sort of cylindrically, it'll have little echoes of War of the Worlds, and it may be coming at such an angle into toward the Earth that it almost feels like it's being piloted. So this gives the folks in North American Air Defense Command, which is where the movie starts, something to say. Well, wait a minute, what's going on here? And that's how the film that's how the film starts at North American Air Defense. And in this shot, this is actually a frame grab that we're seeing from the show, when we hear a PA voice saying, "Colonel Appling to the Deep Space Net, please." And Colonel Appling walks over to the Deep Space Net, where this young woman is working, and he comes sauntering over, and he says, "If this is for another dinner invitation, then you're gone. Your cantaloupe was superb last night." And she has a snappy little response of, "Well, I hope you like dessert as well, yada, yada." So there was a little
I'll just interject about when I was watching this yesterday. I was like, "Oh, I love that interaction." And, you wouldn't get it today. And I'm like, "Oh, but that seems very authentic," you know?
Right. Well, it was authentic. It was also real, and it was personal, and it was very human. And there's another thing about it, too, that I will tell you about Prometheus, that line that he spoke just sounds like an ordinary line. But I had just finished writing a miniseries that was supposed to be my trade-off for having created The Incredible Hulk, which, of course, never got produced. But in writing Ivanhoe, which was set in the 1100s with Robin Hood and King Arthur and all the Arthurian, all the legends going on, I wanted to give that script a kind of a classical feel. So I wasn't sure what I meant by that, except so I went back and looked at a lot of the great classic films like The Man for All Seasons and Beckett and The Lion in Winter. And I noticed something going on in The Lion in Winter that sort of caught my ear. And I picked up the script. I got a copy of the original play, and I'm reading the lines that William Goldman had written. And like one of the lines that King Richard says is, or King Henry says, my life, when it is written, will read better than it lived. Henry FitzEmpress, first Plantagenet, the noblest soldier of a noble time. He led men well. And what's happening here is the dialogue, I realized, was written in meter. It was written in iambic meter. Iambic is the same meter that Shakespeare wrote in. Ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. It's like a heartbeat. Iambic is. And so when I wrote the dialogue for Ivanhoe, I wrote it all in iambic meter. And what that means is you've got to figure out what you want to say and then how you can say it so that it is in meter, but doesn't sound like you're forcing it. It just sounds natural. And if this is for another dinner invitation, then you're on. Your cannelloni was superb last night. That's all ba-bump, ba-bump, ba-bump. Because you find where the emphasis must be in each word. Like you don't say cannelloni, you say cannelloni, you know, and superb, you don't say superb, you say superb. So the emphasis there, you have to figure out what syllable the emphasis has to be on. So that when he's saying that, if this isn't for another invitation, then you're on, your cannelloni was superb last night, you know, and then she says, I hope you like dessert as well. It's all in iambic, and it was
just. I just want to interject for a second, because from the earlier conversation you and I had about V, the most fascinating thing was your revelation that you wrote that entire movie, the entire two-part miniseries, in iambic pentameter. Right, Kenny?
That's exactly right. Because by then I was on a roll, and having just finished doing it with Ivanhoe, I said, I wonder if I can do it in a contemporary piece. And I said, you know, while I'm writing Prometheus, I think I'm just going to try that. And indeed, that's what we did. And all the dialogue in it, all the way from beginning to end, is ba bum ba bum ba bum. It's not broken into pentameter, into five beats like Shakespeare's is, but it continues, and it gives the dialogue this remarkable flow that audiences don't even really think about, but it's there, and the actors feel it as well. And as a matter of fact, there was one of the first days we were shooting, Bill came onto the set, and we were doing a scene, and he wasn't getting the words right. You know, he hadn't learned the dialogue exactly like I'd written it. And I explained to him what I was trying to do. And he said, oh, okay, let me go back to the trailer. Let me get it really right. And from that point on, Bill was exactly spot on with his performance, as were all the other actors all the way through. So when you actually see Prometheus and listen to it on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, listen for it, because you'll hear it. Ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. So anyway, just getting on with Prometheus here. He's called it the Deep Space Net because they've discovered that there's something coming, and it's not out of, it's coming from a peculiar area. It's not a spacecraft. The Soviets didn't have anything out that way, and neither did we. So there's an issue. Something's going on, and something's coming. And I wanted to have a big opening for the picture. And I remembered a sequence. This is a frame grab from a movie called The Parallax View that Alan Pakula directed. And it had been out two or three years before. And we had used some stock footage from this in a Bionic Woman episode when this dam opens up and water comes spilling out. We needed water to chase Jamie for something that I'm going to get to, actually. And I remembered this sequence. It was this is a closer shot. And this is a stunt double doubling Warren Beatty. And he's been taken out to this, trying to solve this mystery by this local cop who's is over here. And then he realizes, Beatty does, that he's in deep trouble because He's been lured out here. This guy's about to pull a gun on him and shoot him. And what happens in this sequence is they get into a struggle and they fall in the water and they're carried downstream. And so we went to a Paramount and bought a lot of the footage, not with any Warren Beatty in it, obviously, of course, that we could intercut with our own guys here. And so here's another angle of the same thing. Now, what I've done is I've zoomed in on it. This original angle was a bigger shot. It was a CinemaScope shot, so it was wider. And the cop that you saw in the khaki was standing right here. Can you see me doing that? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. People watching the video.
So what we've done is we've taken the scene and we've literally blown in on the shot. So the cop is no longer in the shot. But what I have is an establishing shot that shows a guy in a blue, denim and this color of trousers standing on a rock right here. And that's where Bill is in our piece. Now, I shot all of Bill's stuff at Tahunga Wash, where there is no dam, and there's very little water, which we had to deal with. But when we cut Bill in with the stock footage of that we bought from Paramount, it looked like he was there. And then as he looks up that way in the movie, the dam opens up and the water starts coming out, and he's just fishing here. And he was standing on the rock fishing, and here's me and one of the special effects guys with me. And this is the Tahunga Wash where we were filming. And as I said, there was very little water. But what I wanted to show was the water was rising, because I would cut to the stock footage of the water coming from the dam. And then it had to rise here, but we couldn't get the water to rise. So when you can't get the water to rise, what do? You have to lower the rock. And that's what we did. We built three rocks. This is the tallest rock, rock number one. And here's the shot out of the film. Frame grab from the film where you can see Bill is on the rock and there's this much space between him and the water. And then we cut to stock footage of more water coming down, pouring. So the water should be getting deeper. And now in this shot, you can see we're at the middle-sized rock. We've dropped the rock into the water a little deeper. And the guys are beginning to stir up the water here with a little pump off screen. I think I even went to a closer angle here. Yeah, to say, hey, see, the water's getting higher, right? And then we cut back to the stock. Oh my God, the water is really coming now. And here we are on the tiniest rock where Bill is literally right down at the water level, still fishing. And you can see us over here with the camera and the water is being churned up here by the special effects guys with just a couple of portable pumps to make it look like it's really getting more to like white water. Here it is. Here's the shot out of the picture that we got that gives you the feeling, oh, my God, the water really is coming up, you know. And what happens next is that Bill hears somebody calling for help, and he starts he's caught. Oh, his first is the shot of the fish and stuff to make sure you see the really water really came up. See, so now we had to get to the sequence where Lori Prang, our leading lady, is holding onto a rock and Bill's coming to help her. And here you really get a good sense of Tahunga Wash and what it really looks like. There is no big white water at Tahunga Wash except this one little piece of water right down here at the bottom where I'm standing in a half a wetsuit. So all of the water that we had that was churning was right here. So we had to figure out how we were gonna make all of that work and to cut it together. Here's me with John McPherson, my great cinematographer, lining up for what we're trying to do. Now, here we have lined up. Here's Laurie hanging onto the side of the rock in that one place where the water's churning by itself. Bix is reaching further. The handheld camera operator is working here with the assistant camera pulling focus beside her. Johnny McPherson behind her, and me talking her through it, talking both of them through it. And here's the shot that we got from that setup. And it looks like she's holding on, you know, barely. And we did a closer angle, just on a slightly longer lens from the same place to get that. And Will doesn't know it yet, but Lori is blind. Her character, Julie, is blind. And she has stumbled into the water, and that's why she's here. Now, you have to get a reverse angle on this. So here we are set up to get the rehearse angle of Bix now reaching down for her. We've moved the camera to the other side, so we're looking back. Notice the Incredible Hulk vests on some of the guys here, big green vests. And the cameraman is down there with his eye in the camera, and we're getting the shot that looks like this in the movie of Bix reaching down for her. And again, we're using all the water we can at this point, and low enough so that we don't see that there's no big water up here or a dam or anything like that, carefully framed. And he's reaching, come on, give me your hand. And then we cut the stock footage, the water getting deeper. And then they fall in the water. The two of them fall in the water and get supposedly swept downstream. And here they are. This is the stunt guys from the parallax view in the water. But Lori Prang is in khaki, the same thing that the cop was wearing, so that their costumes match. And then we'd get close-ups of Bix and Lori being swept downstream. But they had to go down this same little slide of some water about five times so that we could get different shots. But they're all, each time, they're going through the same. But then we'd cut back to these big shots from the movie, and it really looked like, oh, my God. And you intercut Bix. And, I mean, it's this huge production value that we just bought by the foot from Paramount that we could cut in with our movie making and make it work. And finally, they get to some still water, and he drags her out onto the side, and they're both, and this is me helping Lori out after we'd finished the sequence.
Kenny, one thing I was going to actually ask about there, because first of all, for those who haven't watched this episode yet, first of all, you should do it. It is on iTunes as well. That's where I found it. And this scene goes on for a while. So, like, the way you're describing it, like, it you don't even realize, like, if you haven't seen the scene, it's actually a pretty long set piece. And
yeah,
and I think that's what's really impressive is not just, like, brilliant use of camera angle and stock footage in a way that, I never thought of it when I was watching. It's like, yeah, that looks just like Warren Beatty's stunt double from Parallax View. Go ahead.
Well, just to interject, it is one of those things that when, you know, you're old curmudgeon-y, 40 plus years in the future, a lot of times, content, especially for television, you can usually look at it and you can see the seams, as they say. And I had no hint that any of these tricks you're talking about, you see it in big screen movies sometimes where you're just like, oh, they cut a lot of corners. And you talking about all this, I just watched this yesterday. I'm like, yeah, I didn't have a feel that any of this. I just want to get in one comment from the chat, though. Cam A. Egan points out, and Lori's hair stays perfectly dry, but I think that's important.
That's her superpower.
She was really drenched, and they of course had wetsuits on underneath because it was the water was cold.
That's what I was going to ask, actually, Kenny, because I felt like one thing that was so smart about this too, their performances. Like as I'm watching it, I'm like, wow. Like I was going to say, Kenny, you put them through real hell. It looks like, but now it sounds like. Well, maybe it was so cold that's what they were using, but I completely believe that these characters went through that.
Yeah.
Well, that's a testament to them. And they really, they're both such wonderful, wonderful actors. Lori had played a handicapped girl in our very first 2-hour movie after the pilot, Death in the Family. She was a paraplegic in that movie. But she's had such a wonderful, warm quality. When we were doing Prometheus, I said to Bix, I think we ought to bring Lori back. It's been 4 years. And he said, that's perfect. And
that's how dumb I am, Kenny. I watched that episode, I talked to you not even 3 months ago, and I was like, she looks familiar, but I actually chalked it up that I thought that it was just that she, physically resembles Faye Grant from V, so I thought, I'm like, oh, it must be because to me, she just kind of looks like Faye, but I'm curious, because her last name is Maxwell. And V has the character Robin Maxwell.
Yeah,
is that an inside thing for you, or is that a friend?
That was my wife's family, Robert Maxwell and Katie Maxwell, and Katie's also our daughter's name. The Maxwells have turned up several times in the whole thing, but it does. I love to drop names of people and friends and family and crew into a lot of the shows. One of the Bionic Woman episodes I wrote had every character was somebody on the crew. It was fun. But anyway, in terms of the story, obviously this is what my guy does. He falls into somebody's life, Dr. Banner, and he helps them, as indeed he helped her not drown. And he's going to help her more, because when we first meet her, she's very bitter. She's a concert pianist who has been sidelined by her blindness. And her brother sees to her. She's been living in this isolated cabin, and he stretched a rope down to the creek so she could get back and forth and have a little outside time without having to have somebody with her all the time. But on this particular day, she tried to go away from the rope and fell in the creek, and it just drove home to her how much, what anguish she has at not being at Carnegie Hall anymore. In spite of her extraordinary skill as a pianist, and she has no self-confidence anymore. She doesn't want to get out of the house anymore. And what Bill does and accomplishes, as Dr. Banner, only Dr. Banner can, is to help her get back into her life, and which is the emotional core of the story between Bill, Bix, and Laurie. And that's obviously what makes the Hulk successful, is that emotional core. And that's what he does in the course of this particular story. Meanwhile, back at North American Air Defense Command, they're getting more and more curious about this thing. Now, this is a set, obviously, that we built at the studio at Universal. They've got some visuals now on the object that is coming in, and it's sort of cylindrical, and it seems to be coming at a very shallow angle, which is odd, and it seems like maybe it's being piloted, and also they're getting a lot of gamma radiation from it. Now, we know when we hear the word gamma in a story that has Dr. David Banner in it, you got to be careful about where, you know, it's going to go and what's going to happen. And indeed, we begin to get the sense that there's a big military operation going on. I love looking down on helicopters, which, of course, means you have to have two helicopters, which I had a lot for this show. And all of this was shot at Falls Lake up on the what was then the back lot at Universal to give us a sense of this big military operation going on. Two choppers and such coming in. And then from inside the command post here, we see the choppers landing in the background. All is, of course, time-consuming. And incidentally, the whole two-hour piece was shot in only about 14, 15 days. So this is, you know, a tremendous amount of production value and such. But that's, again, what I wanted to draw the audience in right away from the beginning, as you were mentioning, you just get, wait a minute, this is a big deal. And I wanted to grab an audience and really have them drawn in and by the mystery of what's going on and everything too. And now Jack McGee has been chasing after the creature and has come to a nearby town where the Hulk had been spotted. And he, hears about what's going on up here. And he's coming up to check on what's going on. Jack, the investigative reporter, who loves to get into people's faces and indeed literally getting into their faces here. And he senses that there's something, a bigger story here than maybe meets the eye, and is not quite sure what's, but then they say, you know, you're step away from here and move away. And Jack also notices somebody wearing this uniform, which has Prometheus in it, and the flame, which, of course, Prometheus was the god who stole fire from the heavens and brought it to us. And so there's a little allegorical thing that begins to go on in the audience's mind, I hope, about what does that symbol mean? And we'll find out more later. And while Jack is supposedly leaving the area, he manages to go into a truck where he sees some guys coming out with uniforms. He goes inside, good old Jack, he grabs a uniform for himself because, you never know, might come in handy. And then we go back to North American Air Defense. It's getting closer, and this is a countdown. It's showing us getting it closer. Meanwhile, Bill, our Dr. Banner, has taken Laurie out, Katie, out to help her get used to getting around without a rope. And what he's showing her here is how you can tell direction even though you're blind. And he points out to her where the sun is, and she can feel it. And by feeling where the sun is and knowing the time of day, she can say, okay, then I'm looking to the southeast. and write. And so Bill is helping her to grow out of her isolation. And she says, yeah, and then while during this scene, a cloud comes over, and then she says, wait a minute, but then there's no sun. And he said, ah, well, when there's no sun, then you want to find a tree and feel around until you find the moss on the tree, because the moss will always be on the north side of the tree, because that's the part that gets the least sunlight. And so Dr. Banner is doing what he always does by coming into someone's life, discovering the problems that they have, and trying to help them. And she is incredibly, you know, appreciative of this. And already you can see on her face that he's opening up a world to her. And that's what Bill did so well, and what we tried to write into, you know, all of the episodes. Meanwhile, coming flying in, this is a visual effect that we actually made. This was before CGI and all of that. There's something flying in really fast past camera and heading down toward the Earth. They're out walking, and it crashes, it explodes, and something nearby, and the birds are flying out, and little bushes are falling over and stuff. So there's a moment where Laurie and Bix are knocked off their feet, and she's scared and worried again, and Bix says, okay, it's all right, I'll go out and see what's going on there, and he takes her and heads her back toward her house. And then he goes to where this meteor has landed. Now, obviously, a meteor hits normally is going to make a crater, but we couldn't afford that. So I had to say, okay, it's coming in at enough of a slanted angle that it actually came scuttering down the side, this hillside here. And this was out at Indian Dunes, a nearby local area where we did a lot of wilderness kind of shooting. And so Bix is up at the top. This was shot on a 20-to-1 lens so that I could zoom in. I could start on a close-up of Bix and then zoom out and all the way out to reveal the big rock at the bottom, which is sparkling and twinkling. And Joe's music begins to come into play here and adding a sense of mystery and otherworldliness as Bix gets a little closer and closer to it. And he begins to sense something wrong. And pulling these frame grabs was interesting to watch him just getting the first feeling of it here. And then as he gets closer, you can see it on his face. I mean, he says, wait, 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 something's wrong, something's weird. And he ends up touching it and then stumbling backwards. And as he stumbles backwards, his hand goes down onto a beehive that has fallen nearby. And oops, this is not a good sign, because we know where this is going. The bees are swarming. We stuck bee-like things on Bix's face, and we got some shots of swarming bees that we superimposed over this as he's flailing and flailing. But oh my God, here we are, and we know what's coming. And he hulks out. And then Louis is tormented by it. He grabs the beehive and hurls it away, flying it off into the distance. And then he comes stumbling back toward where he had come from, the cabin where Laurie is living. She doesn't know what's going on. Somebody's pounding at the door, and then they blast the door in, which crashes down, and she is terrified, but senses that it's him, but not quite. And as she reaches out, she touches and feels it's not his face anymore. And then we see the transition from going from Louis back toward Bill, but then something goes wonky. And this was another thing that I was really enjoyed doing, was creating a transition that didn't make it all the way. And suddenly he was not the Hulk, but neither was he Dr. Banner. He was stuck in between.
Just to jump in about that, by the way, that I was noticing that, Bill's face looks reminiscent of Lou Ferrigno's face, you know? Yeah. So it's like, right. It's this great in between. It's not just, oh, we gave him big eyebrows. It's like, it really does look like it's in the middle. And right. I thought that was, it was really impressive how well that worked. Yeah. You know?
Well, it's, you know, and it's the weird thing is too, I mean, again, this was all before CGI, before you could have tentacles coming out of pirate spaces and taking the nose off of Voldemort and all, you know,
what were you going to jump in with, Eric?
Well, I was going to say also, two things. One, the acting he did here was great too, because it's kind of cool. He's taken a cue from Lou Ferrigno. Like the way he approached it, I thought was really like that helped sell it. Like you're saying, Kenny, in the absence of having CG, I mean, right. I think the prosthetic, it looked like he had on his forehead was great, but really also his performance shifts. It's something we see him sort of Hulk out a little bit, but this in-between character was really a fascinating performance by Bill Bixby.
Well, yeah, that's. I mean, Bix is an extraordinary actor, and we talked about, okay, what do we think? And I said, I think simple, childlike. At the same time, there's enough banner inside him to have some sense of it, but not enough. And it's like he's in a bad dream, you know. Yeah. And that's what we were leaning toward, and what Bix played so extraordinarily. And I mean, we had to do this the same way they did the Wolfman, you know, back in the 40s, where you put a little makeup on and then you do a little more and then you film a little more and then you put a little more makeup on. I mean, it's ridiculously time consuming. And particularly nowadays when you can, you know, do it so quickly with magical CGI. And he asks for a mirror. And of course, she's a blind woman. She doesn't have a mirror. And so he picks up a teapot, and he looks at his reflection in the bottom of the teapot, very shiny teapot, which he then really makes him crazier, and he crushes the teapot, crunch, and we get this expression of horror and tears coming from him. It's an extraordinary performance because he's lost and has no reference points and nowhere to go and how to deal with it. So he was really brilliant. And Jack, in the meantime, has put on one of those uniforms and is borrowed. I'm going to borrow this Jeep right now, so that he can go up and be snooping and be our eyes watching what's happening on the outside, and also inveigling his way into this operation. And here we are, Johnny McPherson sitting over here in the camera, and I'm on the top of the crane. As we were on the top of that hill that you saw, where we had created the slide down to where the meteor was, and this is looking down into that area, and Prometheus's first advance teams have gotten here. And in the course of the story, Laurie had somebody came pounding at her door, Prometheus did, and said, "You're going to have to leave with us now." They'd taken her away. She managed to get away, and she left Bill in a closet and saying, "Stay here till I come back." And she manages to get away when the truck stops at one point, and by virtue of what Bill had taught her about how to find direction when she's out in the wilderness, she manages to get back to where he is to get him out of the closet, literally out of the closet, and try to get him away from these people whom she senses are, not in his best interest. And they end up, oops, at the wrong place, back where it started, at the site of the crash. And we've got two Jet Rangers going around and around over this thing, and then the big Prometheus helicopter, which was this monster Sikorsky, comes rolling in over the top, and Bix is looking and doesn't get what's going on. It's just making him angry. All of this stuff coming in, it's making him angrier. Also, he has the proximity of the Rhea Gamma coming out of the rock. Prometheus has got something dangling below it, which we're going to discover is a container to pick him up. And bear in mind the difficulty and the danger of working with two helicopters above the ground, another helicopter dangling something on top of them. And so in addition to those three helicopter pilots, I had a fourth helicopter pilot who was on the ground And he was the only one that talked to the helicopters. If I had to tell, have them tell him something, I would tell him something, and then he communicated it to them, because he had to constantly be watching all the tail rotors and who was where. And so we didn't get into any difficulties. And everybody knew if something goes wrong, which way do they go, which way do we go? So it's a huge safety issue.
Speaking of safety, I did want to ask you a quick question. I know that regulations with filming with helicopters would change a few years later because of the tragedy on the set of the Twilight Zone movie. So what you did, it seems to me that was the one takeaway, you know, from like, you know, enjoying it from the narrative, but then from the behind the scenes standpoint, I feel like, you know, a few years later, you wouldn't have been able to do all of what you're describing right now, right?
Well, it's interesting because when you remember that the opening sequence of V is a firefight with two helicopters flying over and explosives and pyrotechnics and stuff going on. And we were filming that on the location, the exact same location where only 2 weeks earlier, the two children and Vic Morrow had been killed when a helicopter crashed on top of them at that spot.
Wow.
And so Warner's was very nervous about it. I remember the guy from Warner's Insurance came down to me and said, can you give me an idea of what you're planning to do here? And I said, can I give you an idea? Yeah, come into my trailer. And I spread out for him a table size ground plan of the whole area where we were working, where all of the helicopter paths were mattered and noted and drawn out each direction for each take, each shot, where all of the explosives were, which explosives were going to go with which shot. And, you know, and it was really, really carefully choreographed, coordinated and then choreographed so that everybody knew what was happening every moment. And he said, do you always do this when you're working with helicopters? And I said, well, I do, you know, when I'm working with explosives and children and animals. And yes, of course I do. Why? And he said, well, on the Twilight Zone set, they were just flying by the seat of their pants. He said, it was a nightmare. This never should have happened. And a lot of people should have gone to jail because of the death of those three people. So it was, now we're doing this scene that we're talking about here in Prometheus. This is like 5 years, 4 years before I did V, but still my thinking there was the same thing. Safety is no accident. And that's what we would always hold as our mantra on the set. So we always knew exactly where we had to go and what the safety issues were. And also there's an ambulance standing by and a fire truck. And certainly we had a wealth of helicopters if we needed to helicopter anybody to a hospital. So all of that has to be factored in when you're doing something like this. But and particularly here, I mean, here you can see the whole thing. This is from the picture helicopter looking down across the Prometheus helicopter with the Jet Ranger helicopter underneath it with Bix and Lori down here at the bottom. And one of the helicopters, I think this is about the point where Bix hulks out. You just get so angry at what's going on and all the noise and everything. And it turns into the creature, and Louis is not happy by the situation. The helicopters are getting closer. More contingents of the Prometheus people are encircling him. He's feeling more and more trapped. Jack is up on a hillside with his binoculars, watching this whole thing, going, "Holy cow! It's him! It's the guy I've been looking for all these years." And Big Lou picks up a stump and throws it at the helicopter. We made a helicopter strut that we could put pyrotechnics on and just have the hit and the explosion. And then the helicopter spins out of control, supposedly, and ducks down behind trees where we set off this big fireball explosion to make it seem as though the helicopter has crashed. But we do make it clear that the men got out. That was important to broadcast standards, so we didn't just kill them.
Although, Kenny, the teaser, when I watched on iTunes, made it look, you know, it took out the middle shot where you see it actually landing safely. Mm-hmm. But the teaser's brilliant because it's like, oh my God, did Hulk just kill some random guy?
Exactly. Well, that's the tease that you want, the classic cliffhanger tease, you know.
I've got two questions about this, Kenny. The first is, was this aired over 2 weeks, or did they give you 2 hours?
No, it was a two-parter. It was aired over 2 weeks.
And
which is a great way to start a series new season, because you grab the audience and then you hook them in for the second week, you know?
Yeah, no, and you can really feel that, and you know, Joe's music does a great job sort of those last few minutes, you know, as the creature emerges and all that, and it's all like, okay, I know this is part one of two, and I can imagine just watching it like, oh, how are they going to get out of this? Oh, to be continued, okay. Let's talk about that red container. What is that? How big is it? I'm fascinated by the red container.
It's really big. It came up. It came in two pieces, two halves, two quarters that were taken, brought up to this location in Indian Dunes on flatbed trucks. One of them fell off of the truck on the way up, and they had to pick it up and put it back together. And the helicopter is as I said, a big Sikorsky, and because I needed a heavy lift or vehicle, and it was I'm not sure, it's probably made out of fiberglass, the dome, because I needed something that I could, you know, I mean, it's sort of corny, but we had to find a way to trap. How do you trap an alien if it's on the ground? Well, maybe we should lower something on top of it. So that was sort of the game plan here. And as the helicopter comes in over top, Lori and the camera right on the ground, looking up across them there. And then I needed to get to this shot where it could be lowered down on top of him. But it was very wonky to try to do that. It was very dangerous for Lou and Lori to be there while this thing was being lowered over them by a helicopter with wind currents blowing it back and forth to get the shot. And here's how we did it. Here's the Lori and Lou are on the inside here. The whole crew is, the rest of the crew is all around as it gets lowered down. And so we lowered it all the way in on top of them. And then we, then everybody, and this is me right here on the radio, talking to the helicopter pilot who's talking to the other helicopter pilots and everybody else on the crew to stage the scene. So everybody was here to ease it down so we could get it down onto the ground. And once we did get it onto the ground, everybody ran out of the shot, and then the chopper just lifted it off, and we got this shot of it lifting off, and I reversed the film so that it looked like it was coming down on top of Lou and Lori. But that was the only way we could do it safely for them. And that gives you a sense of the size of it too. I mean, it was a big honker. And McGee is watching this too. And then once it's lowered down, we heard this sort of grinding sound, like it was, you know, the idea was it was a steam shovel or something. It was scooping them up and takes a big divot out of the ground, and with Lori and Lou supposedly on the inside of it. And begins to lift off and head up away. And one of the things that I said to Joe is, look, we got three helicopters going. It's a lot of noise. Helicopters are terrible when you're trying to do music, because the sound of helicopters, particularly three of them, particularly if one's a gigantic Sikorsky, really eats up the soundtrack. And I said, Joe, let's synthesize the sound of a helicopter blade and make it part of the percussion in your musical score. So when you hear the score, the music score for what's happening here, the helicopter is in rhythm with the music that Joe's playing. So it's all with the drums and everything, so that it's all in rhythm. And that way we could actually use the helicopter sound, but not have the helicopter sound eat up the music. And it was the first time I think anybody had ever done that, and it certainly worked and really helped us preserve the great music and not have it all just get lost in helicopter noise.
Yeah, Kenny, yeah. I was actually specifically, thank you so much for talking about that, because I thought the music at the I know, Christian, you were talking about the music when the dome's there and he hulks out, but this moment here, I was like, oh my God, that music's amazing. And the percussion, I watched this late at night listening to my headphones because my boys were asleep, you know? And I mean, I was like ready to jump into battle. Like, it was such an exciting way to end it. And one thing I read about was, and Christian, I know you brought up the soundtrack before, the idea that this episode's music was so next level, it warranted the release of its own album. But I think I read that there was like more musicians on this episode than usual, like upwards of like 40 or so.
Yeah. We had a pretty fair sized orchestra. I mean, generally you've got 35 pieces or so for a live studio orchestra.
Yeah, right.
And plus we had a synthesizer working with us too. This was the early days of synthesizers. But I think we had maybe 40-50 players for this, so that we had the big percussion section, because with all the militaristic kind of feel naturally since sort of tends you toward drums and drum beats and that sort of thing, it helps to sell, you know, to sell military, and that was part of it. Yes, so we did have a larger orchestra, and the interesting thing too is on the we were on the dubbing stage dubbing it, and people kept walking in saying, "What feature is this?" You know, and I said, "Oh, it's just an episode, a couple episodes of a TV show." What? You know, because there was so much huge production value. We're about to get to some more of that here. I want to show you this though too. This, of course, is Lou Ferrigno, who plays the Incredible Hulk. This is my dear departed pal, who was Bill's stunt double, Frank Orsatti, and our stunt coordinator on the series. And we also needed a stunt double for Lou. And, you know, it was hard, but we finally found this guy, Manuel Perry, Manny, who's got very close to the same physique. He's not as big, but the same size. And he's black. But doesn't matter when you're putting green makeup on him. And Manny was the stunt double for Lou through the whole series. And a wonderful, wonderful guy, became a big time stunt coordinator, second unit director since then, and still with us, and you know, and a great guy. But I always sort of loved that underneath the green makeup, I had a black guy. It was great. You know, diversity before it was a factor in Hollywood, you know. Okay, so this, the part two, the next week, starts where sort of we left off. The helicopter obviously has lowered it down onto some sort of flatbed thing here. We got a shot. Again, I've got two helicopters working, and one of them has got a camera in it, because you want to always, if you've got two helicopters, you always want to use one of them to get aerial shots, which we did, like this one here. As it's being brought into where? And we had discovered this tunnel near the Newhall area up north of Los Angeles. The doors are ours. It does not have these big vault doors on it. We created these big vault doors so that it would look like it was an important, you know, really secure kind of place. Actually, it was just a tunnel that went back about 300 yards and ended. We have no idea why the tunnel was there, but it was available for us to use, and so we made the doors to make it, you know, look even better. And here we see that we're beginning to move into it, and this the dome had to be created, incidentally, in this size so that it would fit into this tunnel. So the tunnel sort of dictated the size of the dome that we could use. And you can see that the dome has got punches in it. This is supposedly where the Hulk has been trying to break out from the inside. And we had several moments and shots in the movie where you see them appear, where they're being slammed from the inside with big growls and noise and, you know, and that sort of thing. Here's a close angle as it's wheeling in toward the tunnel, 18 to 14 millimeter lens, really wide. So I've got the helicopters flying through, and this is driving in and all of that. And then the problem came when I said to Chuck Davis, you know, what kind of a facility, and Chuck said to me, what kind of a facility do you picture we are going to? And I said, well, it's got to be something that looks like it could contain something like this. It's got to be a big kind of setting. Everybody was sort of saying, well, where are we going to find that? And then I remembered, I said, you know what? A year earlier, I had shot a 2-hour Bionic Woman episode called Doomsday is Tomorrow, where Jamie, our leading lady, my bionic woman, had to fight her way down through a military kind of industrial complex to get to the lowest level, to the core, where this doomsday device had been set timing, and it with the time was winding down, and she had to get down and stop it, or it was going to literally destroy the world. It was a scientist who had Einstein type, who said, "I want to people to realize," and he said, "Once I've triggered the started the doomsday device, turned it on, armed it, then if there is a nuclear explosion, it will go off, and it will there will be nobody left alive on Earth." So the idea was to scare the world into not going to nuclear disaster. So we were looking for locations and for the doomsday thing, and Jamie, here's Lindsay, my leading lady, had gone through a whole bunch before we get to this point. This is she's getting near the basement of it now, so she thinks, and the defense of the old scientist incidentally has died, and the control and the security for this place has been left in the hands of Alex, who is a computer like Hal. And he has his own agenda, Alex does, and his agenda is to prevent her from getting there. And so this is what he looks like. And we see him all over the place, keeping his eye on her. And it was sort of interesting because in a way, and I talk about it in that episode, that they were kind of cousins. He was a machine with the mind of a human, and she was a human with the parts of a machine with her bionic legs and arm. So they were kind of cousins. Anyway, she's going down, and she comes out this doorway here up on the right-hand side there. And when we don't know where we are, and neither does she, and she comes in a little further, and then realizes, okay, I got to go down this way. And then we get to this shot, which shows her here on this level. And she begins to look, and this shot pans down until we see this gigantic hole in the ground, which looks very high tech. And oh my God, what's going on here? And the doomsday device is supposedly located down below this level. And she's got to, get down there, and she realizes it. So she's taking a look and trying to figure out, okay, how do I do this? And here she is rappelling down on the inside. She couldn't just jump because we couldn't put an airbag down there. She's going down and down from below looking up. I mean, these are great stuff, right? This was something I'd seen in the newspaper that was being constructed up by Castaic Lake. This is a power generating station that was under construction. And we went up there and they let us in for a day or so that we could get these shots of her inside and making her way. Now she's down here real small and Alex is saying, "You can't go any further, Jamie." And she says, "Oh yeah, watch this." And she's going to start down from here, going down to the next place. So I remembered this place and I said, they finished building that place now. Let's go up and take a look at that, because this, what you have just seen, was only 1/5 the size of the place. And I said, so I took my Chuck Davis and my production team up there and I showed them this, which is the interior now of the Castaic power station. And we decided, okay, well, this looks like a James Bond set. These are the holes where the giant turbines go into, that the water flows through to create the electricity. And then once they have put the generator in there, they put a cap on it. That's what this is. This is a huge, gigantic concrete cap slab that goes on top of this, and it's moved back and forth by these cranes overhead. I said, this looks like it could work. And Jack is of course along for the ride and seeing this and giving us his perspective on the inside. But you can see that it's a really fantastic place to look, and it really looks like we spent $100 million to build a James Bond set. It actually costs about $5,000 or $6,000. That's all from the DWP that the
Department works power station. Like you were able to go there when it's working?
Oh Oh, yeah. Yeah, because by then it was built and working and all the turbines were in there. And when it was working while we were there, and a bit noisy, too. But I just brought in 100 extras and four spotlights, actually, to just enhance it a little bit. And interestingly, there was no way to drive this truck into this place because the ground level is up here. At this level, but I asked the guys, hey, could we use your cranes to lower our truck down into here? And they said, oh, yeah, sure. So the cranes actually helped us get the truck and all the stuff into place. And then we had to cheat the entrance make it look as though they had driven in. And it was a pretty cool set to see and to have to use. And it really gave us tremendous production values. Here you see this lid thing sliding even a little closer. And then to make it even a little sexier, at one point, we turned the lights out. And now it begins to look really, and the music starts here at this point, the music cue. Before that, it's just voices echoing and PA systems calling and all of that sort of stuff. But when the lights go out, it really begins to look like Close Encounters. And Joe's music was terrific to enhance all of that. And here is an angle looking from the other direction. The camera's here. You can see the guys riding this thing in as the dome has been lifted up off the truck and is headed down in this direction, supposedly to be put in this deep, deep hole over here. Here's a hangout looking down in it. The deep, deep hole actually is only about 6 feet deep. Actually, these lights here are sitting at the bottom of the hole. But to make it look deeper, we put black duvetyn in here, and we put smaller lights on the inside, you know, to make it look sort of forced perspective, like there was a room for the thing to go in and to go down into it. And we got great little pickup, like this is a shot. This is a shadow of some of those guys walking on the dome thing back here, as it was all rolling in together, and it was pretty impressive. And again, it wasn't very expensive. I just had a bunch of extras and Jack McGee, and we got the shot we needed. And here's Jack watching it now. Jack, in the story, discovers that what's going on here. That they are holding this creature, thinking that it is an alien, and he is discovered to be a reporter, as he is, and of course that freaks everybody out, particularly the military people, and Jack tries to convince them, no, you don't know what you're dealing with, and that's a part of the McGee storyline as we go on through it. But eventually, what happens at the end is the creature manages to get loose down inside and causes some damage to start, and he manages to scoop Laurie up and get her and take her out. And when I was in the editing room, I was looking at it, and George Ohanian, my editor, I said, well, George, it's not a big enough ending. It needs a bigger ending. And he said, but this is all the film you shot, Kenny. I said, well, I know. I shot what I had to shoot. But he said, what do you have in mind? And I said, well, maybe when he does this thing here where the sparks are going off, it triggers a fire and gets a small fire gets started or something. And maybe the fire spreads and maybe the equipment starts to burn and explode. And maybe eventually, like, the whole inside of the place is blowing up. And, of course, George is looking at me like I've gone crazy, you know, okay, but you didn't shoot any of that. And I said, no, well, you know what? Let's call our film librarian at Universal, George Sperry, a very little sort of librarian type guy. And we'd say, George, here's what we need. Interiors exploding and maybe the side of a mountain blowing out, you know. And a couple of days later, George Sperry called me and said, okay, Kenny, come and I'll show you what I've got. And he had found a film that Universal had released about maybe 4 years earlier called Operation Crossbow, which was about a true story about the Allies assault on the V2 rocket facility that was being built in Germany to launch the V2 rockets onto London. And they went in and blew it up, and most of them died doing it. And the Operation Crossbow had been made. Universal owned the film, And they did a lot of really big stuff. And so we looked at all the film and started figuring out how we could put it together. And so this was little stuff that we did to add some fire in a sense that there's oil leaks and fire is spreading. And we did, this is at shot at Castaic, some of the big equipment there that is sparking up and beginning to have difficulties. These are just our sparks that we added to their, you know, machinery. And here's a shot from Operation Crossbow that's intercut with this, which, holy cow, looks so much bigger with all this fire and stuff going in the background. And you can't linger on it for too long, because as you look at it right now, you begin to say, wait a minute, that doesn't quite look real. No, it doesn't. But going past in a sequence of cuts, it does actually work pretty well. There's another thing that I discovered when I was up here the first time doing the show with Lindsay on The Bionic Woman. The tunnels, the pipes that they have up there to funnel the water down to the turbines are massive. Here's Lindsay discovering that she can get out of here. She has to escape at the end of the Doomsday show. And so we got shots of her running through these gigantic tunnels. They're almost 12 feet tall. And it's just a great look. Again, it was free and it was there. And I could do that, and I could get a shot like this of her running with a light behind her and running out and escaping on the Bionic Woman. And I realized, this is cool. Well, this is how I can get Laurie and Lou out of the place. He's got her in his arms. He pokes a hole, bangs a hole, busts a hole into the concrete to go. So now, which gets him inside, he steps inside the tunnel. And then I've got Laurie and Lou carrying Laurie, running up the same tunnel that Lindsay ran up all those years ago. And meanwhile, intercut with that, here's where they're trying to close it up. They're trying to close the valves to keep him hemmed in. And this is how they control the water that is actually used to generate the electricity up there. The water comes down the hill from Lake Castaic and comes down into these tunnels. And this is a big ball valve, same kind of valve that you have on a kitchen sink or in a bathroom, where you just turn the ball and it closes off the piece. Only these are like 10 feet tall and made out of cast iron. You know, it's a fantastic look. And that stuff was intercut with this stock footage, bang, boom, from the Operation Crossbow. Here's one shot. We only use it very briefly because you can really see the V2 rockets all lined up here that they were building at Peenemünde for World War II. And this is pretty clearly a matte shot, where this has been a matte painting and with fire added to it. But again, when it goes by in a couple of quick cuts, boom, boom, you don't register it. You don't really notice that here's the top of a V2 rocket, you know, right down here at the bottom. But for me, it gave me the kind of, okay, this is a really bang, boom, blowing up thing going on as Lou is trying to stop this thing from coming down on top of him and Laurie. You can get a sense of how big the ball valve is here with Lou under it. And him straining and straining, trying to hold her. Finally, he sets her down and he's just pushing it himself. And we did a couple of cuts that seemed to make this trigger something upstairs as he strains and strains and pushes it up high enough for a bigger explosion to happen upstairs. Again, stock footage, all with miniatures and matte paintings from Operation Crossbow, who had way more money than I did to make the movie. But I could use all of their production value to give mine all that much more scope. And explosives and stuff falling and debris. Some of these shots are also in V when they blow up the chemistry plant near the end of the first, my original 4-hour movie. Some of these shots you'd find in there too, because we said, let's grab a couple of those that we used in Prometheus. And ultimately, Lou gets to carry Laurie outside, get Banner away from all the gamma stuff that's going on inside, so he's able to make the transition back. And as she is with him and then slowly realizes that it's now back to Bill, and and she's tearful, and it's really an emotional scene. It's so powerful for Bix too. They were both just absolutely crying when they did it, and she could feel it was his face, and it was so tactile and so human and so heartfelt. That was, you know, it was a wonderful evening on the set in the back lot where we shot this. And this, I love this expression on Bix's face here. It was like he had somehow come through it all. It was a really sweet moment. And for Laurie too, and what a performance. And so watching her throughout, you are absolutely convinced that she is blind. I mean, you've seen people play blind people, then it doesn't really feel like it, you know, but with Laurie, it was just extraordinary. And then there's the final moment at the end of the movie where it's time for him to move on and for her to have gained, thanks to him, the self-confidence. She's, you know, I think in the scene she says something like, if I can get through the tunnels at Prometheus and all that stuff in the forest, I think I can get from the plaza to Carnegie Hall, okay. So they have a sweet moment as are together, and then they get to the bus where she says, tells him that she's writing a concerto for him in three parts for each of his personas. And it's really, really a touching moment, that it really a heartbreaking to have to see them be separated. But he's content that he's done what he needed to do. And we have the moment of him ushering her onto the bus, and the bus pulls away and our boy is left standing there and turns to walk away. And there we are.
And of course we hear Joe's wonderful score. I loved having story time for these episodes. Obviously, much more enjoyable, of course, having just watched them. And people can, as Eric mentioned, they can find the Prometheus two-part episode. You can find it on iTunes, apparently. And if you're a physical media guy like me, I still have my full series box set. Just a word that you used, I think, is really important, Kenny. It's the tragedy of this show, and of course of David Banner's life, is you go through this really emotional thing. It brings people really close together. And he's like, okay, but now I got to go because that's what I do. Obviously, yeah. More than ever, he has to move.
Work is finished here. I've got to move on. You know, it's a classic. It's a classic. I mean, how many Westerns did we see like that when we were kids, you know? The guy rides into town, the guy fixes things up, and then the guy rides out of town. And it's the classic hero that must keep going in Banner's case. It's not because, well, I'd just rather go to another town. No, I have to go because I've got McGee still after me. My trauma, my nightmare continues. But fortunately, Lori is in a better place than she was when our hero met her to begin with. To me, that there was always the heart and soul of what the show was all about. Prometheus, McGee also makes the discovery that Prometheus is not all that altruistic. That indeed they are looking to steal fire from the heavens, that there are military aspects of it, that the civilian scientists who are involved in the Prometheus story were unaware of. They're going, what? You know, we thought this was all for the glory of science and making contact with an alien race that might be able to help us, as opposed to taking their power and using it against us in a militaristic way. So there was another important subtext that was playing throughout the entire 2-hour story.
Right, go ahead, Eric.
Oh yeah, sorry. I think also too one McGee's story, by the way, I just want to say, like, even really interesting turn in this 2-part episode where we see, you know, McGee is always dodging, going after him, and this one, you could see he's you're rounding him out as a character nicely in this one too. Where
yeah,
he's conflicted on what to do and what his responsibility is.
Yeah, and there's a lovely scene where he is really trying to, Banner, you know it's me, or he doesn't know it's Banner, but he says, you know me, you know who I am, you know, and well, that was the beauty of Jack, too, because Jack was a sensational actor, a wonderful acting coach as well, too, and a renowned as a drama teacher. And Jack absolutely appreciated it. And at early on, when we were first starting the series, you know, he even said to me at one point, when and it was one of the episodes where he didn't have that much to do, and he said, you know, can we find more to do with the, can you guys find more for to do with the character, so that I'm not just coming in and saying, I'm looking for a large hulking creature that was reported to be. I said, yeah, no, that was always my intent, Jack. And over the course of the series, we tried to constantly be developing aspects like that with him. And I love the two, I think it was also a two-parter, wasn't it, where he's with Banner and Banner's all bandaged up and he doesn't know who he's with. And particularly in this one, it was just an ideal way to show Jack as a reporter on his own track, on his own line, on his own storyline, trying to follow up on what was going on here and discovering that it was a really big deal and that the scientists were not aware that they had been duped a bit, more than a bit, by the military aspect of it and revelatory of that. So it was, I agree with you, thanks. You know, it's I really loved giving Jack that much more to work with, and he was great in a way.
And I think your Prometheus logo might have inspired Space Force's logo. So I don't know if you got a paycheck from the U.S. government, but I mean, Kenny, you might have something to stand on here.
Wow.
Copyright.
Yeah. The Space Force. Well, oh my God! On my website there are a couple of posters. I think it came from a Canadian artist of in a V uniform, one of the visitor uniforms, with Donald Trump as the Space Force commander. It's very funny to see on my website, which is just my website is just my name, kennethjohnson.us. You can see it there.
Exactly what I was going to mention, that's where they can get more, kennethjohnson.us. And it's interesting that, Eric, you brought up McGee, because that's what I was going to talk about. I think that as a device for the series, it's great to have this, you know, when we spoke last time, it's sort of like, you know, the fugitive, you know, Dr. Kimball's, you know, he's got to move on there. He's being chased. But I love that this episode, these two episodes in particular, you really do get more than just, the guy asking questions, trying to get the story, you know?
Right. I mean, he was, Jack's character was, of course, as you know, inspired by Inspector Javert in Les Miserables, who was determined to find Jean Valjean, you know, Victor Hugo made a very three-dimensional character. So you absolutely understood his drive and his determination and the law and how the law was so important to him. Humanity aside, the law was most important. And Jack certainly has that drive and that desire to get the big story that he's been chasing for 3.5 years already at this point. But at the same time, he's a human being and he's got his own feelings and thoughts. And that's what we tried to mine as much as we could. And because it enriches the whole story when all of your characters have got a really good three-dimensionality to them.
Well, Kenny, we really appreciate you being so generous with your time and the show and tell. It was so much fun. And, you know, I'm going to continue working my way through the box set. And, you know, you'll get a message for the next time. I'm like, how about these episodes? But I appreciate it. I have one final question, which, sure. You know, when we spoke the last time, you talked about there was, I think it was Death in the Family was the episode where you got the note from Stan Lee that there was a bear and it was, could it be a robot bear? So my question while I was watching this episode, the bees, did Stan say, hey, how about robot bees? Or had he
no, we were well past that at that point. And by that point, you know, Stan said, hey, Kenny, whatever you want to do, you do it, man, because you yeah. get it. And it was so kind of him to say several times and to so many people that he really felt that our show was the spark plug that really started the ball rolling for the Marvel Universe. And that was, you know, I was amazed when he said it to me more than once. And it was high praise indeed, coming by from a man whose creativity and genius I so aspire to.
It was a big deal because the comics of that era, the Hulk issues, it says Marvel's TV sensation. They were very proud. Yeah. And I'm sorry, Eric, your final thought there.
It wasn't even a final thought. It was just going back to the bees for 1 second. So I was watching this on the iPad. The bee effect is so impressive on an iPad. At first, I'm like, what's going on with my screen? Like, because it really looked like they were literally crawling on the inside of my screen. Like, it was such an impressive effect. And it was also like 1 in the morning, 1:30. I'm like, I'm a little tired. The coffee's wearing off. I'm like, what's going on?
Oh my God, are there bugs on my screen?
Not again. But yeah, it was, and I thought that moment too, the effect with the bees, a great sound design, by the way, in both episodes, including the sound of him inside that pod. I thought was maybe one of the neatest tricks, where obviously you're not going to have poor Lou Ferrigno hang out inside that thing while it's going everywhere.
But
that sounded like you did.
Well, that's the point. I mean, the whole idea is cheating. And in my seminar, my filmmaking seminar, I have my final, fourth session of the seminar is called Cheats: The Tricks of the Filmmaking Trade. And it's about the cheating that you have to do when you're making film to make an audience think they're hearing or seeing something that they couldn't be, or that they're not really hearing, or no, that's not what you, well, the stock footage is a perfect example of that. No, we didn't really set off all those explosions and do that. You know, we found it in stock footage, and we, you know, used that many, many times to make the production value bigger. As a producer director, what I'm always looking for is to make the show not only as emotionally right as it can be, but also give it the most production value and feeling of time and effort that has gone into something. So I'm glad it works for you.
Oh yeah, I agree about the B effect. So just a quick programming note for everybody watching live on Geekscape. Stay tuned, the Geekscape YouTube channel. Coming up at the top of the hour, which is 4 Eastern, 1 Pacific, I will be doing a special on a show that preempted Kenny's show in November of 1978. I will be speaking with Jeremy Kuhn, who has made a documentary called A Strange Disturbance in the Force, which is about the Star Wars holiday special. It is fascinating. Anybody who knows that special knows it well. And the fact that Jeremy made a documentary is so exciting. I'm so excited to talk to him about it. So you can find that over on Geekscape, really just in mere minutes. Excited to have that conversation, and I hope people from the chat pop over. But Kenny, as I said, it was great to talk to you. I look forward to coming up with excuses to talk to you in the new year. KennethJohnson.us, and you can find me Twitter, Instagram at ChristianDMZ. Please subscribe to Geekscape, and I have my personal podcast, The Black Cast. Eric Connor, where can people find you?
Well, occasionally I'm hanging out in the dark corners of the Blatcast and Geekscape universe. You can find me at Count Eric Connor. And I wish all of you a most joyous and prosperous life day in honor of that.
Star Wars holiday special, yes. We mentioned Stan Lee a moment ago. And as the great Stan Lee would say, Excelsior!
Bless you guys. Thank you.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.